He spent 3 hours over his letter, did my master, as long as it takes me to lick the coal dust off my dicky. He tears up half a quire of paper, splays 5 pen nibs with the force of his adoration.
Look not for any peace, my heart, having become a slave to this beauty's tyranny. Dazzled am I by this sun's rays, and my torments cannot be assuaged.
That's not the high road to the rumpling of the bedcovers. She's got one ninny between them already. Speak from the heart, I finally exhort, and all good women have a missionary streak, sir. Convince her her orifice will be your salvation, and she's yours.
When I want your advice, puss, I'll ask for it, he says, all at once hoity-toity.
But at last he manages to pen 10 pages. A rake, a profligate, a card sharper, a cashiered officer well on the way to rack and ruin when first he saw, as if it were a glimpse of grace, her face. His angel, his good angel, who will lead him from perdition.
Oh, what a masterpiece he penned.
Ah, Tabs, she sobs, for she calls me Tabs. I never meant to wreak such havoc with a pure heart when I smiled to see a booted cat. And put his paper next to her heart, and swore it was a good soul that sent her his vows, and she was too much in love with virtue to withstand him, if, she adds, for she's a sensible girl, he's neither old as the hills nor ugly as sin, that is.
An admirable little note the lady sent him in return, per figaro here and there. She adopts a responsive yet uncompromising tone, for, says she, how can she usefully discuss his passion further without a glimpse of his person? He kisses her letter once, twice, 1,000 times. She must and will see me. I shall serenade her this very evening. So, when dusk falls, off we trot to the piazza. He, with an old guitar he pawned his sword to buy, and most, if I may say so, outlandishly rigged out in some kind of vagabond mountebank's outfit he bartered his gold-braided waistcoat with poor Piero braying in the square for, moonstruck Zani, lovelorn loon he was himself, and even plastered his face with flour to make it white, poor fool, and so ram home his heart-sick state. There she is, the evening star with the clouds around her. But such a creaking of carts in the square, such a clatter and crash as they dismantle the stalls, such an ululation of ballad singers and oration of the nostrum peddlers and perturbation of errand boys that though he wails out his heart to her, "Oh, my beloved!" Why, she, all in a dream, sits with her gaze in the middle distance, where there's a crescent moon stuck on the sky behind the cathedral, pretty as a painted stage, and so is she. Does she hear him? Not a grace note. Does she see him? Never a glance.
Up you go, puss. Tell her to look my way.
If Rococo's a piece of cake, that chaste, tasteful early Palladian stumped many a better cat than I in its time. Agility is not in it when it comes to Palladian. Daring alone will carry the day, and though the first story is graced with a hefty caryatid whose bulbous loincloth and tremendous pecks facilitate the first ascent, the Doric column on her head proves a horse of a different colour, I can tell you. Had I not seen my precious tabby crouched in the gutter above me, keening encouragement, I, even I, might never have braved that flying upward leap that brought me, as if Harlequin himself on wires, in one bound, to her window-sill.
"Dear God,"
the lady says, and jumps. I see she, too, ah, sentimental thing, clutches a well-thumbed letter.
"Puss in boots."
I bow her with a courtly flourish. What luck to hear no sniff or sneeze. Where's Hag? A sudden flux sped her to the privy, not a moment to lose.
"Cast your eye below,"
I hiss.
"Him you know of lurks below, in white, with the big hat, ready to sing you an evening ditty."
The bedroom door creaks open. Then, and whee, through the air, Puss goes. Discretion is the better part. And, for both their sweet sakes, I did it. The sight of both their bright eyes inspired me to the never-before-attempted by me or any other cat in boots or out of them, the death-defying triple somersault, and a three-story drop to the ground, what's more, a grand descent.
Only the merest trifle winded, I'm proud to say. I neatly land on all my fours, and Tabs goes wild. Huzzah! But has my master witnessed my triumph? Has he my arse?
He's tuning up that old mandolin and breaks as down I come again into his song. I would never have said in the normal course of things his voice would charm the birds out of the trees, like mine, and yet the bustle died for him. The homeward turning costers paused in their tracks to hearken. The preening street girls forgot their hard-edged smiles as they turned to him, and some of the old ones wept, they did.
Tabs! Up on the roof there, prick up your ears, for by its power I know my heart is in his voice.
And now the lady lowers her eyes to him and smiles as once she smiled at me. Then,
bang!
A stern hand pulls the shutters to, and it was as if all the violets in all the baskets of all the flower sellers drooped and faded at once. And spring stopped dead in its tracks, and might, this time, not come at all. And the bustle and the busyness of the square that had so magically quieted for his song now rose up again with the harsh clamour of the loss of love. And we trudged drearily off to dirty sheets and a mean supper of bread and cheese, all I can steal him. But at least the poor soul manifests a hearty appetite now she knows he's in the world and not the ugliest of mortals. For the first time since that fateful morning, sleeps sound. But sleep comes hard to Puss tonight. He takes a midnight stroll across the square, soon comfortably discusses a choice morsel of salt cod his tabby friend found among the ashes on the hearth before our converse turns to other matters.
"Rats," she says, "and take your boots off, you uncouth bugger. Those 3-inch heels wreak havoc with the soft flesh of my underbelly."
When we'd recovered ourselves a little, I ask her what she means by those rats of hers, and she proposes her scheme to me. How my master must pose as a rat-catcher, and I, his ambulant marmalade rat-trap. How we will then go kill the rats that ravage Milady's bedchamber, the day the old fool goes to fetch his rents, and she can have her will of the lad at leisure, for if there's one thing the hag fears more than a cat, it's a rat, and she'll cower in a cupboard till the last rat is off the premises before she comes out. Oh, this tabby one, sharp as a tack is she. I congratulate her ingenuity with a few affectionate cuffs around the head and home again for breakfast. Ubiquitous Puss, here, there, and everywhere. Who's your Figaro? Master applauds the rat ploy, but, as to the rats themselves, how are they to arrive in the house in the first place, he queries. Nothing easier, sir. My accomplice, a witty soubrette, who lives among the cinders, dedicated as she is to the young lady's happiness, will personally strew a large number of dead and dying rats she has herself collected about the bedroom of the said ingenue's duenna, and most particularly that of the said ingenue herself. This to be done tomorrow morning, as soon as Sir Pantaloon rides out to fetch his rents. By good fortune, down in the square, applying for hire, a rat-catcher. Since our hag cannot abide either rat or a cat, it falls to Milady to escort the rat-catcher, none other than yourself, sir, and his intrepid hunter, myself, to the site of the infestation. Once you're in her bedroom, sir, if you don't know what to do, then I can't help you.
Keep your foul thoughts to yourself, puss.
Some things, I see, are sacrosanct from humour. Sure enough, prompt at 5 in the bleak next morning, I observe with my own eyes the lovely lady's lubbery husband hump off on his horse like a sack of potatoes to rake in his dues. We're ready with our sign.
Signor Furioso, the living death of rats.
And in the leathers he's borrowed from the porter, I hardly recognize him myself, not with the false moustache. He coaxes the chambermaid with a few kisses, poor deceived girl. Love knows no shame, and so we install ourselves under a certain shuttered window with the great pile of traps she's lent us, the sign of our profession, puss perched atop them, bearing the humble yet determined look of a sworn enemy of vermin. We've not waited more than 15 minutes, and just as well. So many rat-plagued bergamots approach us already and are not easily dissuaded from employing us when the front door flies open on a lusty scream. The hag, aghast, flings her arms round flinching Furioso. How fortuitous to find him! But at the whiff of me, she's sneezing so valiantly, her eyes awash, the vertical gutters of her nostrils aswill with snot. She barely can depict the scenes inside. Rattus domesticus dead in her bed and all, and worse, in the missus' room. So, Signor Furioso and his questing puss are ushered into the very sanctuary of the goddess. Our presence announced by a fanfare from her keeper on the nose harp. Achoo! Sweet and pleasant, in a morning gown of loose linen, our ingenue jumps at the tattoo of my boot heels, but recovers instantly, and the wheezing, hawking hag is in no state to sniffle more than,
I see that cat before.
Not a chance, says my master. Why, he's come but yesterday with me from Milano.
So she has to make do with that. My Tabs has lined the very stairs with rats. She's made a morgue of the hag's room, but something more lively of the lady's. For some of her prey she's very cleverly not killed, but crippled. A big black beastie weaves its way towards us over the Turkey carpet. Puss, pounce! Between screaming and sneezing, the hag's in a fine state, I can tell you, though milady exhibits a most praiseworthy and collected presence of mind, being, I guess, a young woman of no small grasp, so perhaps she has a sniff of the plot already. My master goes down, hands and knees under the bed.
My God, he cries, there is the biggest hole here in the wainscoting I ever saw in all my professional career, and there's an army of black rats gathering behind it, ready to storm through. To arms!
But, for all her terror, the hag's loath to leave the master and me alone to deal with the rats. She casts her eye on a silver-backed hairbrush, a coral rosary, twitters, hovers, screeches, mutters, until milady assures her amidst scenes of rising pandemonium,
I shall stay here myself and see that Signor Furioso doesn't make off with my trinkets. You go and recover yourself with an infusion of friar's balsam, and don't come back until I call.
The hag departs, quick as a flash. La Belle turns the key in the door on her and softly laughs. The naughty one. Dusting the slut fluff from his knees, Signor Furioso now stands slowly upright. Swiftly, he removes his false moustache, for no element of the farcical must mar this first delirious encounter of these lovers, must it? Poor soul, how his hands tremble! Accustomed as I am to the splendid feline nakedness of my kind, that offers no concealment of that soul made manifest in the flesh of lovers, I am always a little moved by the poignant reticence with which humanity shyly hesitates to divest itself of its clutter of concealing rags in the presence of desire. So, first, These two smile a little, as if to say, "How strange to meet you here," uncertain of a loving welcome still. And do I deceive myself, or do I see a tear, a twinkle in the corner of his eye? But who is it steps towards the other first? Why? She. Women, I think, are, of the two sexes, the more keenly tuned to the sweet music of their bodies. A penny for my foul thoughts, indeed. Does she, that wise, grave personage in the negligee, think you've staged this grand charade merely in order to kiss her hand? But then, oh, what a pretty blush! Steps back. Now it's his turn to take two steps forward in the saraband of Eros. I could wish, though, they'd dance a little faster. The hag will soon recover from her spasms, and shall she find them in flagrante? His hand, then, trembling upon her bosom, hers initially more hesitant, sequentially more purposeful upon his breeches. Then their strange trance breaks. That sentimental havering done, I never saw two fall to it with such appetite. As if the whirlwind got into their fingers, they strip each other bare in a twinkling, and she falls back on the bed, shows him the target, he displays the dart, scores an instant bullseye. Bravo! Never can that old bed have shook with such a storm before, and their sweet, choked mutterings, poor things.
Ah, never! My darling! More!
And etc., etc. Enough to melt the thorniest heart. He rises up on his elbows once and gasps at me.
Mimic the murder of the rats, puss! Mask the music of Venus with the clamour of Diana!
A hunting we shall go. Loyal to the last, I play catch as catch can with Tab's dead rats, giving the dying the coup de grâce and baying with resonant vigour to drown the extravagant screeches that break forth from that who would have suspected more passionate young woman as she comes off in fine style. Full marks, master. At that, the old hag comes battering at the door. What's going on? Why for the racket? And the door rattles on its hinges.
"Peace!" cries Signor Furioso. "Haven't I just now blocked the great hole?"
But milady's in no hurry to don her smock again. She takes her lovely time about it. So full of pleasure gratified her languorous limbs, you'd think her very navel smiled. She pecks my master prettily thank you on the cheek, wets the gum on his false moustache with the tip of her strawberry tongue, and sticks it back on his upper lip for him. Then lets her wardress into the scene of the faux carnage with the most modest and irreproachable air in the world.
See, Puss has slaughtered all the rats.
I rush, purring proud, to greet the hag. Instantly her eyes overflow.
Why are the bedclothes so disordered?
She squeaks, not quite blinded yet by phlegm, and chosen for her post from all the other applicants on account of her suspicious mind, even, O dutiful, when in grande peur des rats.
Puss had a mighty battle with the biggest beast you ever saw upon this very bed. Can't you see the blood stains on the sheets? And now, what do we owe you, Signor Furioso, for this singular service?
100 ducats, says I. Quick as a flash, for I know my master, left to himself, would, like an honourable fool, take nothing.
"That's the entire household expenses for a month,"
wails Avarice's well-chosen accomplice.
"And worth every penny, for those rats would have eaten us out of house and home."
I see the glimmerings of sturdy backbone in this little lady.
"Go, pay them from your private savings that I know of, that you've skimmed off the housekeeping."
Muttering and moaning, but nothing for it except to do as she is bid, and the furious sir and I take off a laundry basket full of dead rats as souvenir, we drop it, plop, into the nearest sewer, and sit down to one dinner honestly paid for a wonder. But the young fool is off his feed again, pushes his plate aside, laughs, weeps, buries his head in his hands, and time again goes to the window to stare at the shutters behind which his sweetheart scrubs the blood away, and my dear Tabs rests from her supreme exertions. He sits for a while and scribbles, rips the page in four, hurls it aside. I spear a falling fragment with a claw. Dear God, he's took to writing poetry.
I must and will have her forever,
he exclaims. I see my plan has come to nothing. Satisfaction has not satisfied him. That soul they both saw in one another's bodies has such insatiable hunger no single meal could ever appease it. I fall to the toilet of my hinder parts, my favorite stance when contemplating the ways of the world.
How can I live without her?
You did so for 27 years, sir, and never missed her for a moment.
I am burning with the fever of love.
Then we are spared the expense of fires.
I shall steal her away from her husband to live with me.
What do you propose to live on, sir?
Kisses, he says distractedly. Embraces.
Well, he won't grow fat on that, sir.
Though she will.
And then, more mouths to feed.
I'm sick and tired of your foul-mouthed barbs, puss, he snaps.
And yet my heart is moved, for now he speaks the plain, clear, foolish rhetoric of love. And who is there cunning enough to help him to happiness but I? Scheme, loyal puss, scheme. My wash completed, I step out across the square to visit that charming she who's wormed her way directly into my own hitherto untrammeled heart with her sharp wits and her pretty ways. She exhibits warm emotion to see me, and oh, what news she has to tell me, news of a rapt and personal nature that turns my mind to thoughts of the future, and yes, domestic plans of a most familial nature. She saved me a pig's trotter, a whole entire pig's trotter, the missus smuggled to her with a wink. A feast. Masticating, I muse. Recapitulate, I suggest, the daily motions of Sir Pantaloon when he's at home. They set the cathedral clock by him, so rigid and so regular his habits. Up at the crack, he meagrely breakfasts off yesterday's crusts and a cup of cold water to spare the expense of heating it up. Down to his counting-house, counting out his money, until a bowl of well-watered gruel at midday. The afternoon he devotes to usury, bankrupting here a small tradesman, there a weeping widow, for fun and profit. Dinner's luxurious. At 4, soup with a bit of rancid beef or a tough bird in it. He's an arrangement with the butcher, takes unsold stock off his hands in return for a shut mouth about a pie that had a finger in it. From 4:30 until 5:30, he unlocks the shutters and lets his wife look out, oh, don't I know, while Hag sits beside her to make sure she doesn't smile. Oh, that blessed flux, those precious loose minutes that set the game in motion. And while she breathes the air of evening, why, he checks upon his chest of gems, his bales of silk, all those treasures he loves too much to share with daylight. And if he wastes a candle when he so indulges himself, why, any man is entitled to one little extravagance. Another draught of Adam's ale healthily concludes the day. Up he trucks besides Missus, and, since she is his prized possession, consents to finger her a little. He palpitates her hide and slaps her flanks.
What a good bargain!
Alack, can do no more. Not wishing to profligate his natural essence, and so drifts off to sinless slumber amid the prospects of tomorrow's gold.
How rich is he?
Croesus? Enough to keep 2 loving couples? Sumptuous? Early in the uncandled morning, groping to the privy, bleared with sleep, were the old man to place his foot upon the subfusket volatile fur of a shadow-camouflaged young tabby cat? You read my thoughts, my love.
I say to my master, now,
You get yourself a doctor's gown, impedimenta, all complete, or I am done with you.
What's this, puss?
Do as I say, and never mind the reason. The less you know of why, the better. So he expends a few of the hag's ducats on a black gown with a white collar, and his skull cap and his black bag, and under my direction makes himself another sign that announces with all due pomposity how he is il fame de dottore, ex-cured, pains prevented, bones set, graduate of Bologna, physician extraordinary. He demands to know, is she to play the invalid, to give him further access to her bedroom?
I'll clasp her in my arms and jump out of the window. We too shall both perform a triple somersault of love.
You just mind your own business, sir, and let me mind it for you after my own fashion. Another raw and misty morning. Here in the hills will the weather ever change? So bleak it is and dreary, but there he stands, grave as a sermon in his black gown, and half the market people come with coughs and boils and broken heads, and I dispense the plasters and the vials of coloured water I'd forethoughtfully stowed in his bag, he too agitato to sell for himself. And who knows, might we not have stumbled on a profitable profession for future pursuit if my present plans miscarry? Until dawn shoots his little yet how flaming arrow past the cathedral on which the clock strikes six. At the last stroke, that famous door flies open once again, and the hag lets rip.
Oh, doctor, come as quick as you can. Our good man's taken a sorry tumble.
And weeping fit to float a smack she is, so doesn't see the doctor's apprentice is most colourfully and completely furred and whiskered. The old booby is flat out at the foot of the stair, his head at an acute angle that might turn chronic, and a big bunch of keys still gripped in his right hand as if they were the keys to heaven marked wanted on voyage, and Missus, in her wrap, bends over him with a pretty air of concern.
A fall!
She begins when she sees the doctor, but stops short when she sees your servant Puss looking as suitably down in the mouth as his chronic smile will let him, humping his master's stock in trade and hawing like a sawbones.
You again,
she says, and can't forbear to giggle, but the dragon's too blubbered to hear. My master puts his ear to the old man's chest and shakes his head dolefully. Then takes the mirror from his pocket and puts it to the old man's mouth. Not a breath clouds it. Oh, sad. Oh, sorrowful.
Dead, is he?
Sobs the hag.
Broke his neck, has he?
And she slyly makes a little grab for the keys in spite of her well-orchestrated distress, but Missus slaps her hand and she gives over.
"Let's get him to a softer bed,"
says Master. He ups the corpse, carries it aloft to the room we know full well, bumps Pantaloon down, twitches an eyelid, taps a kneecap, feels a pulse.
"Dead as a doornail," he pronounces. "It's not a doctor you want, it's an undertaker."
Missus has a handkerchief very dutifully and correctly to her eyes.
"You just run along and get one,"
she says to Hag.
And then I'll read the will, because I don't think he's forgotten you, the faithful servant. Oh, my goodness, no.
So off goes Hag. You never saw a woman of her accumulated Christmases sprint so fast. As soon as they are left alone, no trifling this time, they're at it. Hammer and tongs down on the carpet since the bed is occupé. Up and down his arse, in and out her legs. Then she heaves him up and throws him on his back. Her turn at the grind now, and you'd think she'll never stop. Toujours discret, Puss occupies himself in unfastening the shutters and throwing the windows open to the beautiful beginnings of morning in whose lively yet fragrant air his sensitive nostrils catch the first and vernal hint of spring. In a few moments, my dear friend joins me. I notice already, or is it only my fond imagination, a charming new portliness in her gait, hitherto so elastic, so spring-heeled. And there we sit upon the window-sill like the two genii and protectors of the house. Ah, Puss, your rambling days are over. I shall become a hearth-rug cat, a fat and cozy cushion cat, sing to the moon no more, settle at last amid the sedentary joys of a domesticity we two, she and I, have so richly earned. Their cries of rapture rouse me from this pleasant reverie. The hag chooses, naturellement, this tender if outrageous moment to return with the undertaker in his chiffoned topper, plus a brace of mutes black as beetles, glum as bailiffs, bearing the elm box between them to take the corpse away in. But they cheer up something wonderful at the unexpected spectacle before them, and he and she conclude their amorous interlude amidst roars of approbation and torrents of applause. But what a racket the hag makes! Police! Murder! Thieves! Until the master chucks her purseful of gold back again for a gratuity. Meanwhile, I note that sensible young woman, mother naked as she is, has yet the presence of mind to catch hold of her husband's key-ring and sharply tug it from his sere, cold grip. Once she's got the keys secure, she's in charge of all.
"Now, no more of your nonsense," she snaps to Hag. "If I hereby give you the sack, you'll get a handsome gift to go along with you. For now,"
flourishing the keys,
"I am a rich widow, and here,"
indicating to all my bare yet blissful master,
"is the young man who will be my second husband."
When the governess found Signor Pantaleone had indeed remembered her in his will, left her a keepsake of the cup he drank his morning water from, she made not a squeak more, pocketed a fat sum with thanks, and, sneezing, took herself off with no more cries of murder, neither. The old buffoon briskly bundled in his coffin and buried, master comes into a great fortune, and missus rounding out already, and they as happy as pigs in plunk. But my Tabs beat her to it, since cats don't take much time about engendering. 3 fine, new-minted ginger kittens, all complete with snowy socks and shirt fronts, tumble in the cream and tangle Mrs. Knitting, and put a smile on every face, not just their mothers and proud fathers, for Tabs and I smile all day long, and these days we put our hearts in it. So may all your wives, if you need them, be rich and pretty. And all your husbands, if you want them, be young and virile. And all your cats as wily, perspicacious, and resourceful as Puss in Boots.
The Earl King. The lucidity, the clarity of the light that afternoon was sufficient to itself. Perfect transparency must be impenetrable. These vertical bars of a brass-coloured distillation of light coming down from sulphur-yellow interstices in a sky hunkered with grey clouds that bulge with more rain. It struck the wood with nicotine-stained fingers. The leaves glittered. A cold day of late October, when the withered blackberries dangled like their own dour spooks on the discoloured brambles. There were crisp husks of beechmast and cast acorn cups underfoot in the russet slime of dead bracken, where the rains of the equinox had so soaked the earth that the cold oozed up through the soles of the shoes, lancinating cold of the approach of winter that grips hold of your belly and squeezes it tight. Now the stark elders have an anorexic look. There is not much in the autumn wood to make you smile. But it is not yet, not quite yet, the saddest time of the year. Only there is a haunting sense of the imminent cessation of being. The year, in turning, turns in on itself. Introspective weather, a sickroom hush. The woods enclose. You step between the first trees, and then you are no longer in the open air. The wood swallows you up. There is no way through the wood anymore. This wood has reverted to its original privacy. Once you are inside it, you must stay there until it lets you out again, for there is no clue to guide you through in perfect safety. Grass grew over the track years ago, and now the rabbits and the foxes make their own runs in the subtle labyrinth, and nobody comes. The trees stir with a noise like taffeta skirts of women who have lost themselves in the woods and hunt round hopelessly for the way out. Tumbling crows play tig in the branches of the elms they clotted with their nests, now and then raucously cawing. A little stream with soft margins of marsh runs through the wood, but it has grown sullen with the time of the year. The silent, blackish water thickens now to ice. All will fall still. All lapse. A young girl would go into the wood as trustingly as Red Riding Hood to her granny's house, but this light admits of no ambiguities. And here she will be trapped in her own illusion because everything in the wood is exactly as it seems. The woods enclose and then enclose again, like a system of Chinese boxes opening one into another. The intimate perspectives of the wood changed endlessly around the interloper. The imaginary traveller walking towards an invented distance that perpetually receded before me. It is easy to lose yourself in these woods. The two notes of the song of a bird rose on the still air, as if my girlish and delicious loneliness had been made into a sound. There was a little tangled mist in the thickets, mimicking the tufts of old man's beard that flossed the lower branches of the trees and bushes. Heavy bunches of red berries as ripe and delicious as goblin or enchanted fruit hung on the hawthorns, but the old grass withers, retreats. One by one, the ferns have curled up their hundred eyes and curled back into the earth. The trees threaded a cat's cradle of half-stripped branches over me so that I felt I was in a house of nets. And though the cold wind that always heralds your presence, had I but known it then, blew gentle around me, I thought that nobody was in the wood but me. Earl King will do you grievous harm. Piercingly now, there came again the call of the bird, as desolate as if it came from the throat of the last bird left alive. That call, with all the melancholy of the failing year in it, went directly to my heart. I walked through the wood until all its perspectives converged upon a darkening clearing. As soon as I saw them, I knew at once that all its occupants had been waiting for me from the moment I first stepped into the wood, with the endless patience of wild things who have all the time in the world. It was a garden where all the flowers were birds and beasts, ash-soft doves, diminutive wrens, freckled thrushes, robins in their tawny bibs, huge helmeted crows that shone like patent leather, a blackbird with a yellow bill, voles, shrews, field fares, little brown bunnies with their ears laid together along their backs like spoons, crouching at his feet. A lean, tall, reddish hare up on its great hind legs, nose a-twitch. The rusty fox, its muzzle sharpened to a point, laid its head upon his knee. On the trunk of a scarlet rowan, a squirrel clung to watch him. A cock pheasant delicately stretched his shimmering neck from a break of thorn to peer at him. There was a goat of uncanny whiteness, gleaming like a goat of snow, who turned her mild eyes towards me and bleated softly. so that he knew I had arrived. He smiles. He lays down his pipe, his elder bird call. He lays upon me his irrevocable hand. His eyes are quite green, as if from too much looking at the wood. There are some eyes can eat you. The Earl King lives by himself, all alone in the heart of the wood, in a house which has only the one room. His house is made of sticks and stones, and has grown a pelt of yellow lichen. Grass and weeds grow in the mossy roof. He chops fallen branches for his fire and draws his water from the stream in a tin pail. What does he eat? Why, the bounty of the woodland, stewed nettles, savoury messes of chickweed sprinkled with nutmeg. He cooks the foliage of shepherd's purse as if it were cabbage. He knows which of the frilled, blotched, rotted fungi are fit to eat. He understands their eldritch ways, how they spring up overnight in lightless places and thrive on dead things. Even the homely wood bluets that you cook like tripe with milk and onions, and the egg yolk yellow chanterelle with its fan vaulting and faint scent of apricots all spring up overnight like bubbles of earth, unsustained by nature, existing in a void. And I could believe that it has been the same with him. He came alive from the desire of the woods. He goes out in the morning to gather his unnatural treasures. He handles them as delicately as he does pigeons' eggs. He lays them in one of the baskets he weaves from osiers. He makes salads of the dandelion that he calls rude names, bum pipes or piss the beds, and flavours them with a few leaves of wild strawberry. But he will not touch the brambles. He says the devil spits on them at Michaelmas. His nanny goat, the colour of whey, gives him her abundant milk, and he can make soft cheese that has a unique, rank, amniotic taste. Sometimes he traps a rabbit in a snare of string and makes a soup or stew seasoned with wild garlic. He knows all about the wood and the creatures in it. He told me about the grass snakes, how the old ones open their mouths wide when they smell danger, and the thin little ones disappear down the old ones' throats until the fright is over, and out they come again to run around as usual. He told me how the wise toad who squats among the kingcups by the stream in summer has a very precious jewel in his head. He said the owl was a baker's daughter. Then he smiled at me. He showed me how to thread mats from reeds and weave osier twigs into baskets and into the little cages in which he keeps his singing birds. His kitchen shakes and shivers with birdsong from cage upon cage of singing birds, larks and linnets, which he piles up one on another against the wall, a wall of trapped birds. How cruel it is to keep wild birds in cages. But he laughs at me when I say that, laughs and shows his white pointed teeth with the spittle gleaming on them. He is an excellent housewife. His rustic home is spick and span. He puts his well-scoured saucepan and skillet neatly on the hearth, side by side, like a pair of polished shoes. Over the hearth hang bunches of drying mushrooms, the thin, curling kind they call Jew's ears, which have grown on the elder trees since Judas hanged himself on one. This is the kind of lore, he tells me, tempting my half-belief. He hangs up herbs in bunches to dry, too, thyme, marjoram, sage, vervain, southernwood, yarrow. The room is musical and aromatic, and there is always a wood fire crackling in the grate, a sweet, acrid smoke, a bright, glancing flame. But you cannot get a tune out of the old fiddle hanging on the wall beside the birds, because all its strings are broken. Now, when I go for walks, sometimes in the mornings when the frost has put its shiny thumbprint on the undergrowth, or sometimes, though less frequently, yet more enticingly, in the evenings when the cold darkness settles down, I always go to the Erl King, and he lays me down on his bed of rustling straw, where I lie at the mercy of his huge hands. He is the tender butcher who showed me how the price of flesh is love. "Skin the rabbit," he says. Off come all my clothes. When he combs his hair that is the colour of dead leaves fall out of it. They rustle and drift to the ground as though he were a tree and he can stand as still as a tree. When he wants the doves to flutter softly, crooning as they come down upon his shoulders, those silly, fat, trusting woodies with their pretty wedding rings round their necks. He makes his whistles out of an elder twig, and that is what he uses to call the birds out of the air. All the birds come, and the sweetest singers he will keep in cages. The wind stirs the dark wood. It blows through the bushes. A little of the cold air that blows over graveyards always goes with him. It crisps the hair on the back of my neck. But I am not afraid of him. Only afraid of vertigo. Of the vertigo with which he seizes me. Afraid of falling down. Falling as a bird would fall through the air if the Erl King tied up the winds in his handkerchief and knotted the ends together so they could not get out. Then the moving currents of the air would no longer sustain them, and all the birds would fall at the imperative of gravity, as I fall down for him, and I know it is only because he is kind to me that I do not fall still further. The earth, with its fragile fleece of last summer's dying leaves and grasses, supports me only out of complicity with him, because his flesh is of the same substance as those leaves that are slowly turning into earth. He could thrust me into the seedbed of next year's generation, and I would have to wait until he whistled me up from my darkness before I could come back again. Yet when he shakes out those two clear notes from his bird call, I come, like any other trusting thing that perches on the crook of his wrist. I found the Erl King sitting on an ivy-covered stump, winding all the birds in the wood to him on a diatonic spool of sound. One rising note, one falling note. Such a sweet, piercing call that down there came a soft, chirruping jostle of birds. The clearing was cluttered with dead leaves, some the colour of honey, some the colour of cinders, some the colour of earth. He seemed so much the spirit of the place, I saw without surprise how the fox laid its muzzle fearlessly upon his knee. The brown light of the end of the day drained into the moist, heavy earth, all silent, all still, and the cool smell of night coming. The first drops of rain fell. In the wood, no shelter but his cottage. That was the way I walked into the bird-haunted solitude of the Erl King, who keeps his feathered things in little cages he has woven out of osier twigs, and there they sit and sing for him. Goat's milk to drink from a chipped tin mug. We shall eat the oat cakes he has baked on the hearthstone. Rattle of the rain on the roof. The latch clanks on the door. We are shut up inside with one another, in the brown room, crisp with the scent of burning logs that shiver with tiny flame. And I lie down on the Erl King's creaking palliasse of straw. His skin is the tint and texture of sour cream. He has stiff, russet nipples, ripe as berries. Like a tree that bears bloom and fruit on the same bough together. How pleasing! How lovely! And now... Ah! I feel your sharp teeth in the subaqueous depths of your kisses. The equinoctial gales seize the bare elms and make them whiz and whirl like dervishes. You sink your teeth into my throat and make me scream. The white moon above the clearing coldly illuminates the still tableau of our embracements. How sweet I roamed, or rather used to roam. Once I was the perfect child of the meadows of summer, but then the year turned, the light clarified, and I saw the gaunt Earl King. Tall as a tree with birds in its branches, and he drew me towards him on his magic lasso of inhuman music. If I strung that old fiddle with your hair, we could waltz together to the music as the exhausted daylight founders among the trees. We should have better music than the shrill prothelemians of the larks, stacked in their pretty cages, as the roof creaks with the freight of birds you've lured to it, while we engage in your profane mysteries under the leaves. He strips me to my last nakedness, that underskin of mauve, pearlized satin, like a skinned rabbit. Then dresses me again in an embrace so lucid and encompassing it might be made of water, and shakes over me dead leaves as if into the stream I have become. Sometimes the birds, at random, all singing, strike a chord. His skin covers me entirely. We're like two halves of a seed enclosed in the same integument. I should like to grow enormously small, so that you could swallow me, like those queens in fairy tales who conceive when they swallow a grain of corn or a sesame seed. Then I could lodge inside your body, and you would bear me. The candle flutters and goes out. His touch both consoles and devastates me. I feel my heart pulse, then wither, naked as a stone on the roaring mattress, while the lovely, moony night slides through the window to dapple the flanks of this innocent who makes cages to keep the sweet birds in. Eat me, drink me, thirsty, cankered, goblin-ridden. I go back and back to him to have his fingers strip the tattered skin away and clothe me in his dress of water. This garment that drenches me, its slithering odour, its capacity for drowning. Now the crows drop winter from their wings, invoke the harshest season with their cry. It is growing colder. Scarcely a leaf left on the trees, and the birds come to him in even greater numbers, because, in this hard weather, it is lean pickings. The blackbirds and thrushes must hunt the snails from hedge bottoms and crack the shells on stones. But the Earl King gives them corn, and when he whistles to them, a moment later you cannot see him for the birds that have covered him like a soft fall of feathered snow. He spreads out a goblin feast of fruit for me, such appalling succulence. I lie above him and see the light from the fire sucked into the black vortex of his eye, the emission of light at the centre there that exerts on me such a tremendous pressure it draws me inwards. Eyes green as apples, green as dead sea fruit. A wind rises. It makes a singular, wild, low, rushing sound. What big eyes you have. Eyes of an incomparable luminosity, the numinous phosphorescence of the eyes of lycanthropes. The jellied green of your eyes fixes my reflective face. It is a preservative, like a green liquid amber. It catches me. I am afraid I will be trapped in it forever, like the poor little ants and flies that stuck their feet in resin before the sea covered the Baltic. he winds me into the circle of his eye on a reel of birdsong. There is a black hole in the middle of both your eyes. It is their still center. Looking there makes me giddy, as if I might fall into it. Your green eye is a reducing chamber. If I look into it long enough, I will become as small as my own reflection. I will diminish to a point and vanish. I will be drawn down into that black whirlpool and be consumed by you. I shall become so small you can keep me in one of your osier cages and mock my loss of liberty. I have seen the cage you are weaving for me. It is a very pretty one, and I shall sit hereafter in my cage among the other singing birds, but I shall be dumb from spite. When I realized what the Earl King meant to do to me, I was shaken with a terrible fear, and I did not know what to do, for I loved him with all my heart, and yet I had no wish to join the whistling congregation he kept in his cages, although he looked after them very affectionately, gave them fresh water every day, and fed them well. His embraces were his enticements, and yet, oh yet, they were the branches of which the trap itself was woven. But in his innocence, he never knew he might be the death of me, although I knew from the first moment I saw him how Earl King would do me grievous harm. Although the bow hangs beside the old fiddle on the wall, all the strings are broken, so you cannot play it. I don't know what kind of tunes you might play on it, if it was strung again. Lullabies for foolish virgins, perhaps. And now I know the birds don't sing. They only cry because they can't find their way out of the wood, have lost their flesh when they were dipped in the corrosive pools of his regard, and now must live in cages. Sometimes he lays his head on my lap and lets me comb his lovely hair for him. His combings are leaves of every tree in the wood and dryly susurrate around my feet. His hair falls down over my knees. Silence, like a dream in front of the spitting fire, while he lies at my feet and I comb the dead leaves out of his languorous hair. The robin has built his nest in the thatch again this year. He perches on an unburnt log, cleans his beak, ruffles his plumage. There is a plaintive sweetness in his song, and a certain melancholy, because the year is over. The robin, the friend of man, in spite of the wound in his breast from which Earl King tore out his heart. Lay your head on my knee, so that I can't see the greenish, inward-turning suns of your eyes any more. My hands shake. I shall take two huge handfuls of his rustling hair as he lies half-dreaming, half-waking, and wind them into ropes very softly, so he will not wake up. And softly, with hands as gentle as rain, I shall strangle him with them. Then she will open all the cages and let the birds free. They will change back into young girls, every one, each with the crimson imprint of his love bite on their throats. She will carve off his great mane with the knife he uses to skin the rabbits. She will string the old fiddle with five single strings of ash-brown hair. Then it will play discordant music without a hand touching it. The bow will dance over the new strings of its own accord, and they will cry out, "Mother! Mother! You have murdered me!"
The Snow Child. Midwinter. Invincible. Immaculate. The Count and his wife go riding, he on a grey mare, and she on a black one, wrapped in the glittering pelts of black foxes. and she wore high, black, shining boots with scarlet heels and spurs. Fresh snow fell on snow already fallen. When it ceased, the whole world was white.
I wish I had a girl as white as snow.